I think it's very easy for us to say like, oh, you know, mom's getting older. She started to forget things. It's not normal. It's not normal for older adults to start to forget things. That is something you need to pay attention to.
What so many families do is kind of go, oh, well, we're just going to pretend like nothing's changing and nothing's happening. And, you know, we won't talk about it. And that will just make everything better. And it doesn't.
The conversations that you have now do matter. We sometimes have families that say, well, we don't know what's going to happen. So how can we possibly plan for this? How do we know what to expect? And the reality is that you don't, but that doesn't mean that you don't have the conversations and that you don't plan and that you don't listen to the older adult and what their preferences are and what their hopes are for what aging well will look like for them.
Hello, my fellow teenagers. There's a sentence that almost every family says eventually. It sounds like, Mom, you need some help. And what the older adult actually hears is, you are about to lose your independence. My guest today has spent her career figuring out how to get families past that moment. Jennifer Sakai is an aging life care manager and the founder of Caregiving Corner in Charlotte, North Carolina. Her job, in her own words, is to be an expert in aging well. She and her team walk alongside families for the long haul, assessing what is really going on, building a plan, and coordinating everything from home safety to housing transitions to dementia care. Today, we talk about why safety and freedom are not actually opposite ends on a spectrum, what solo agers need to plan for that nobody tells them, and why the conversations you have now, long before a crisis, are the ones that give you options later. Welcome to the Keen on Aging podcast. I'm Dr. Corinne Allman, and each week I sit down with experts and people living later life with purpose to share honest conversations and practical insights you can use to live this chapter of life on your own terms. One of the first things I want to ask you about is a conversation we have a lot as caregivers where we've got people, families that we're trying to work with, and the older person in the family is hearing other people around them say things like, you need some help. And what they're hearing when they hear the you need some help is, you're losing your independence. You need somebody to take care of you. We're going to take over everything. How do you help families reframe that and get past that initial reaction to the conversation around, hey, you need a little help?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a stumbling block for a lot of families. And it's interesting. I think one of the first things that we should be doing a little bit differently is reframing how we're having the conversation and when we're having the conversation. I think one of the things that we need to be mindful of is to, as we're expressing, whether we're the adult child or the spousal caregiver, as we're expressing what our concerns are, we need to do so in such a way that isn't threatening to the older adult. And it's really talking about what they're seeing and what their concerns are, but then maybe also talking about a solution. So a good example of that might be to say, you know, I'm not sure that I'm comfortable with you driving as far as you have been. What would you think about me coming to get you when you are traveling out of town, making that trip easier? And so I think the mistake that a lot of people make is they kind of announce the concern. They don't always do so at the best time. And it does come across as they're taking over, or they either kind of just leave it there and they're presenting it and just dropping it and waiting for the older adult to respond. And then that's when you're going to get a lot of defensiveness and a lot of, because that person feels like, okay, now the ball's in my court, it's my turn to respond. And I don't agree with that. I think I should be able to drive. I think I'm just fine. And so they're coming back kind of from the other extreme. So when we talk to families, we talk to them about, you know, your adult children are coming at it from this side. They have all of these concerns. You're coming about it from this side. You have all of these things that you need. You need to be able to keep driving, or you want, a lot of them are wants. I want to be able to keep driving. I want to stay in my home. And what we try to get people to see is that they're not actually two different opposite sides on a spectrum. There's a lot of room for compromise. You just have to kind of start the conversation off in a way that's going to open it up for compromise.
It's often this kind of push-pull between safety and independence, or safety and freedom. And this idea that our loved ones want to keep us safe, and we want to keep all of our freedom. And they aren't adversarial, but it can feel that way when we have those discussions. Do you find that families, do they approach this, I'll say, in a timely manner? Do they approach it, you know, when there's time for discussion and we can make plans? Or do families tend to wait until it's kind of that crisis moment and emotions are running high?
Yeah, they tend to wait until it's kind of too late to have non-charged conversations, if you will. I think people tend to wait until there's been, I'll just kind of use driving again as an example. They might wait until there's been an accident, or until there's been an incident where the person has gotten lost, or maybe several fender benders. And then they're presenting it as a new topic. They've never talked to their parents before about driving. And now they're going to sit down and say, I really don't think you should be driving anymore. And so, you know, there's a missed opportunity. If we look at this as all kind of on a spectrum, there's a window of time that you're able to drive as an adult. And then there comes a time that you're no longer able to drive. We know that that's coming. We just don't know when. And so if families start talking about it before it gets to that point and saying things like, Dad, what would you be concerned about that if I saw it happening to you would be a good time for me to bring up that I see this happening and that I have a concern and that we've talked about it and I can remind you about this conversation. And being able to kind of bookmark conversations that have happened before they're actually needed is super helpful.
So you're an aging life care manager, and the first thing I want you to do is tell us what an aging life care manager is, and then tell us, like, in the situations that you just mentioned about having the conversations and talking to your loved ones, how can someone like you and me work in that situation to help families get through the conversations and figure out the next steps?
Yeah. So an aging life care manager, very simply put, is an expert in aging well. And our job as experts is to bring our diverse backgrounds. Some of us are gerontologists, some of us are nurses, social workers, might have a public health background, PT or OT, physical therapy or occupational therapy. And to bring our lens and our skill set to an older adult's aging years to be able to craft a plan for them that keeps them as independent as long as possible, but then also factors in all of the different complicating factors that make all of our situations very unique. Everything from a person's budget to their care needs, family support, dynamics, spirituality, emotional needs, all of it. And we're the person that then walks beside the family during the journey of caregiving for the duration of that older adult's life to help them.
And so when they come to you and they've got these situations, what is it that you're going to do to kind of help the family work through?
Yeah, I think oftentimes when we get pulled into these situations, particularly if it's a family member, oftentimes it's that they've tried to have the conversation. They've tried to have a conversation maybe about, it's mom, it's time to move, or Dad, we don't feel comfortable with you driving anymore. They've tried to have a conversation and it didn't go very well. And they want us to come in to kind of reframe things and to start fresh. And so our job in those situations is really to clinically assess, what does this person need? Where are their spots of weakness? What can they still be doing well that we should be emphasizing as they age, right? Because I think as a society, we tend to look at the, what are we losing? What are we missing? As opposed to, what can this person still do really well? And let's lean into that. And so we're coming into the conversation to say, instead of just tackling this one kind of fire at a time, let's look at this in the larger scale of your aging years. You know, I tell people that we think about retirement years, but retirement is an event. It happens when you leave work. Mm-hmm. And then your aging well is your life after that. And what does aging well mean to you? It's an easy question to ask, but it's a hard one to answer. And everybody's answer should be different. We're not going to match the billboards that we see of people playing tennis or golf at the local clubs or anything like that. Everybody's idea of what that means is different. And so coming in with our clinical expertise, our knowledge of the industry, the resources, understanding how to best deploy assets, insurance policies, things like that, our role is to then be the person that's the expert that's guiding the person mm-hmm. from where they are now to where they want to be able to be aging well.
Yeah, and I love that, the way you put that too, because it's not just let's put out the fire right this minute. It's what do we need to do right this second, but then also to plan for 6 months from now and 6 years from now, so that we are aging well through this whole process, not just putting out this fire and then going, oh, well, that's done, and then waiting until the next fire comes along to make any further planning or further decisions.
Exactly.
So one of the things I see a lot, and I'm sure you do too, is people who are solo aging. And so this is someone who's, you know, by themselves, maybe they never married or their loved ones have passed away, and they need help finding resources and doing things too, but they have some very specific needs. So what do you see as the particular needs of somebody in that situation?
Yeah. So solo agers, I'll say first that it's the fastest growing subgroup of older adults are the people who are entering their aging years without kind of a traditional support structure. And what I mean by that is that we're seeing more and more people enter into their aging years divorced, never married, child-free, maybe they were, you know, choosing a career. It might be somebody that's LGBTQ, they're experiencing estrangement from their family. Mm-hmm. And it could frankly just be somebody that recognizes that their family plays a certain role, but that they would like to have professional people supporting them. Those individuals, I think it's really important that if you can identify that you belong in the category of a solo ager or will belong into the category of a solo ager, is thinking ahead and planning ahead for all of the different times when you might need to call on family or a close friend. The easy ones to think about were if there's an emergency, if you have to go to the hospital, if you have to, let's say you fell and broke your ankle and you had surgery at the hospital, but then you came back and you can't get up to the second floor of your house. You know, you could choose a scenario and think through when are the different times that I would need to call somebody and depend on somebody else. Mm-hmm. And what we try to get people to think about when they're thinking about it is that your period of aging is going to have an unknown number of events that happen that are like that, where to one degree or another, you're going to need to bring people into your circle who can either be decision makers for you or who can help you make decisions. And aligning and engaging the services of an aging life care manager is a great starting point to be able to not only craft the plan for aging well, but also to identify where the gaps are, where are the holes, and who can step in. Maybe it's the aging life care manager, maybe there's another service, but who's going to be able to step in when people would normally pick up the phone and call an adult son or an adult daughter? And so people that are solo agers really have to think through that a little bit earlier than waiting until the first emergency or the first hospitalization comes up before they start thinking about these things.
Yeah. And I think that actually plays into my next question really well, because you can have family that you love and adore, but they may live really far away from you. You know, we're more spread out now than we've ever been before. And so a lot of loved ones who might be that emergency person, you know, they may live in another country or another state and they can't get here quickly and make decisions on your behalf. So let's talk for a minute about long distance caregiving and kind of what you see as the challenges when your adult children or your loved ones live far away.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's another good example of people that really could be categorized as solo agers, because for all intents and purposes, they are aging solo. We had a client long ago, and this was a perfect example. She lived here in Charlotte. Her adult son lived in Boston and her daughter lived in Australia. And she's like, I'm not going to Boston. I don't want to be there for the winters. And she was not going to go to Australia. She's like, I don't know anything about Australia. And so that was a good example of like, okay, we really have to build a community around this client of professionals and build a good relationship with the long distance children to help them figure out, you know, when do you need to hop on a plane if there's something that happens with mom, and versus a situation that an aging life care manager might be able to help with. So in that particular situation, we were the emergency contact. She lived in an assisted living But you and I know that if you have a fall at an assisted living, they're going to send you out to the hospital, right? Exactly. We don't want our clients getting lost to the hospital. We don't want them being the only people reporting out on what happened. And that's even assuming that they're conscious when something like this happens and that they can speak for themselves. And so setting up that situation saved the son time, money, you know, panic for us to be able to call and say, hey, your mom fell, but we're at the hospital. This is no big deal. There doesn't seem to be injuries. They're doing some scans and checks. I'll call you when she gets back to the assisted living. Right. That saved him from having to get on a plane or struggle with the guilt of what do I do? Yeah. And who do I listen to? Do I wait for the doctor to call me? What if the assisted living tells me that it's worse than the doctor told me? I mean, there's all different ways that that situation can go sideways. And yeah, us setting up the communication, an aging life care manager can be a really critical piece of that puzzle because we're sort of the coordinator in the middle. That's the conduit for all of the information flowing, you know, out to people, but also flowing in about our client. And that's so, so helpful for long distance caregiving.
Yeah. I heard somebody else describe us as the quarterback of the football team, right?
Like yes.
You're running all the plays and you're keeping up with everybody and you're telling everybody else what they're supposed to do and what's happening.
Right.
And I think that's a pretty good analogy sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to switch gears on you a little bit and talk about dementia in particular, which, you know, we deal with all the time as care managers. What particular challenges do you think families face or should they be thinking about when their loved one maybe is having some cognitive changes? I'm not even going to go to when we actually get a diagnosis, but let's start with, I am noticing something is different with my loved one. What do I do next? Or what should I be thinking about now?
Right. So I think that there's a missed opportunity in this, the window that you're describing before diagnosis, where families will notice things, but they don't want to say anything. They're very fearful of bringing it up. And it could be because it's kind of a vague concern. It could be that they just can't quite put their finger on what's going on.
Something's not right.
Exactly. Yeah. Just kind of that gut feeling that something's a little bit off. I think that one of the important things is, though, is being candid and having the conversations and doing so, again, coming from a place of positivity that, you know, we have to think about our brain as not as something that starts to break down as we're aging, but as something that we need to be making sure it's in good health and going to the correct specialist for that. And so one of the things I tell families is that if you've got concerns, you know, going ahead and starting to say to your parent and kind of giving them that permission of, mom, you know, if you're ever concerned about anything going on with your memory or anything like that, we really, you know, there's all these doctors, these neurologists that specialize in making sure that your brain is in the best possible shape that it can be and staying on top of the, you know, advancing science and research in that area. And we really should probably get you in with someone like that if you start to have concerns, just so that they can help keep your brain as healthy as possible. So again, kind of, obviously that's going to also be a doctor that looks at it and alerts you to problems, but reframing it from a positive place of saying, this is also the person that knows what you can be doing to keep your brain healthy, is going to be a much easier thing to get the older adult to be interested in doing. I think also, again, not being dismissive of what's going on. I think it's very easy for us to say like, oh, you know, mom's getting older. She started to forget things. It's not normal.
Right.
Stopping the narrative about that's to be expected. Mm-hmm. And we tell, you know, families, keep a journal. You don't want to ever pull out that journal and be like, mom, on December 1st of last year, you did this. It's not for that purpose.
Right.
But if you do find yourself in front of a doctor, you've got a really good written log that you can share privately with them about the things that you've noticed instead of relying on your own memory. But then also I think recognizing and approaching things differently because our brains weren't designed for memory. And so we're not good at memory anyways. And so helping your loved one find ways of compensating and the coping skills, you know, recognizing when they're having difficult, maybe if they're in a crowded environment where there's lots of people talking to them, they have a hard time because their hearing is sort of picking up different conversations and they're having a hard time staying steady in one conversation. You know, that might be good to kind of talk through what's a good coping strategy in that situation. But I think we need to normalize this idea that, first of all, that it's not normal for older adults to start to forget things. That is something right. you need to pay attention to. But the other part of it too is that our brains aren't good at this. We weren't designed to remember things. And so it is okay to use coping strategies. It is okay to write yourself notes. It is okay, you know, to depend on a labeling system, for example, so that your brain doesn't have to think about where you left something that you've never forgotten where it lives in your kitchen, something like that. So talking to families about that early, I think, kind of gives them a different framework for looking at dementia.
You know, the thing is, I have to use labels now, right?
And, right.
You know, young people take notes. They write lists. They do all these things. And when we're younger, we don't think twice about it. It's not a big right. deal. And then as we get older, we start to go, oh, somehow I shouldn't have to use lists or write notes or do anything. When I used to teach college gerontology or even graduate school gerontology classes, I would give them some of the like memory assessments that, you know, we give to a lot of older adults when we're trying to do screenings and things. And a lot of them struggled with those memory assessments. And they're like, oh, does this mean I have dementia? It's like, no, it's just memory is hard. This is yeah. not something that, you know, we're just all naturally good at. But we do somehow have this stereotype that when we're younger, we're just all great at memory. And then as we get older, it gets worse. And it's like, no, you're probably pretty bad at it now. You just don't think about it much because you write yourself notes and you're not at an age where it's concerning you yet.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing I really love about what you said is this idea of framing it positively, particularly mm-hmm. I always try to talk about it in terms of empowerment, right? If you want to control how your brain ages, if you want to have a say-so in this path you're going down, then yeah, going to the neurologist, getting the assessments, knowing where we're at now, doing things to, you know, make it better is the best path. But what so many families do is kind of go, oh, well, we're just going to pretend like nothing's changing and nothing's happening. And, you know, we won't talk about it. And that will just make everything better.
Right.
And
right.
it doesn't.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But it's an easy tendency for families because these are their parents and nobody wants to see their parents decline. Right. And so it is so easy to fall into the temptation of burying your head in the sand because that feels more comfortable to us. Yeah. And again, that's where as aging life care managers, we come in without the emotional connection to the person that the family has. And so we're able to look at the situation very independently and spot things ahead of time before family sees them, but then also kind of be able to look at it differently because this isn't our parent that we're looking at.
And the other piece of that too, much to the frustration of adult children everywhere, we can often come in and say things that they have already said, but yes. because we did not have our diapers changed by anybody in the room, we know things and the adult children don't. And, you know, I have been in many rooms where I go in and repeat something that the adult children have already said, and they're sitting there in the room going, are you kidding me?
Yes, but yes.
Because we are kind of the objective third party, it gets taken differently. It gets interpreted differently by the older adult than it would have otherwise. And that doesn't mean anybody did anything wrong. It's just that sometimes having that outside third party is the person you need. And it could be a care manager. Maybe it's the doctor. Maybe it's your pastor. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's any other trusted person. But, you know, sometimes we just aren't going to listen to our direct family members for whatever exactly. reasons.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's very true. I mean, it's you come into aging and you come into caregiving with those relationships, the parent-child relationships that you've had and that you've been modifying your entire life. Those are intact in whatever form they are in. They are intact when you step into the role of a caregiver of an aging parent, and for better or for worse, that relationship follows you, and it does color and change the way that you interact, the way that you see things, the way that you're able to be patient with one another, all of those things. And relationships are complicated. So,
and whether or not anybody's going to listen to you.
Yes.
I always joke with my team that I'm going to hire them to come in to help with my family.
Yes, exactly.
It's its own thing. Right. Right? Like, let's get outside help in. what do you wish, if you could talk to every family out there, what do you wish they knew that they should do or should know, just know, maybe even things to put in their file for later before a crisis hits, or before, not even a crisis, before things change or start to change with their loved ones? What should they be thinking about now before anything different happens?
I think if I had to sum it up in one thing, I would say that the conversations that you have now do matter. Mm-hmm. We sometimes have families that say, well, we don't know what's going to happen. So how can we possibly plan for this? How do we know what to expect? And the reality is that you don't, but that doesn't mean that you don't have the conversations and that you don't plan and that you don't listen to the older adult and what their preferences are and what their hopes are for what aging well will look like for them. And I think the tendency is for us to just kind of be dismissive because it's like, we're just okay waiting to kind of, okay, another day kicking the can down the road. We'll see what happens. And, you know, and that is easy because again, none of us have a crystal ball to know what lies ahead, but having the conversations earlier give you the ability to have more options and more flexibility than you'll ever have again. And we tell people that every week or month that you wait to have these conversations and to start talking to your loved one about what their preferences are and what aging well looks like to them, you know, where do you want to age? Are you going to move to a 55 plus community? Do you want to stay in the home where you've raised children for 40 years? Do you want to go back to your original hometown? All of these things are part of people's answers, conceivably. And if we're not asking those questions, we don't have that information. And so every week or month that goes by that you're not having those conversations means that that's less information that you're getting from the person to be able to use as a supportive family member when you are in a crisis situation and having to make decisions.
Yeah, the best way to not get what you want is to have not talked about it.
Exactly.
Or just assume, oh, my kids know what I want. My family members know what I would want them to do. Do they?
Right,
are you sure? I want to pick up on one thing you talked about just then about the home, because mm-hmm. one of the things I see all the time is the intent to stay at home as long as possible. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very common wish for people. But individuals, couples have not actually looked around their home and said, is this an age-friendly home? So what should families, if I'm thinking I want to stay in my home as long as possible, what are the aspects of that home that I should look at to start changing or modifying now before I'm coming home from the hospital and already need it all done? Because the last thing we want to do is live through a home renovation while also recovering from some major event.
Right, right. Yeah, that's too much fun at one time. Yes. Yeah, so I think the most important thing is to tell people if you've got somebody that comes in that has, there's what they call a CAPS designation, Certified Aging in Place Specialist, those individuals will often be doing 600 point home safety assessments. And so I tell people that if you want a 600 long bullet list of honey to-dos when you come out of the hospital, then you can wait until the last minute. But nobody wants 600 things to do. And so because it is, you know, when you think about home renovations, I think people tend to think about the easy things, the low-hanging fruit, the stairs. You know, what are we going to do about these stairs? Is there a full bathroom downstairs? If all of your showers are upstairs, that presents an immediate need for a workaround. So I tell people those are two big things, but if you can't think of the other 598 things that somebody with this expertise would be coming into your home looking at, you really do need to be hiring somebody that comes in with this expertise to say, yep, I've looked at your home top to bottom and here's what I see. And it's going to be anything from lighting to flooring, transitions, how tall your bed is, how tall your toilet is. You know, if you have to launch yourself into your bed at night, that you're only going to be in launch mode for a certain amount of your life, and then launching is hard, right? So, yeah. so we want to look at those things. We've got a PT on our team, and she travels everywhere with her measuring tape, and she looks at the height of chairs and the height of sofas and all of those kinds of things. You know, the thresholds and whether or not a threshold is, if there's a one step down maybe to your back patio, is there a place where you can put a grab bar, or is there definitely not a place that you can put a grab bar? Right. So all of those little things make up the 600 plus points that somebody is going to be coming into the home looking at. So it is critical, because a lot of people, a lot of builders, frankly, aren't building homes to be lifelong homes. And so people that have purchased homes for raising their families. And so they're not the same homes that they need to be in for aging without having to worry about a lot of those things. So if somebody's in the house that they want to be in, which again, 100% of our clients want to be where they're at. They don't want to, nobody's excited about going to the nursing homes. Then you definitely need to recognize that it's more than just looking at, do I need a bigger bathroom? Do I need a walk-in shower? That's important, but that's not everything. And so bringing somebody in that can really walk you through the level of detail, you know, kitchen cabinets, do you have to bend to a lower cabinet, or do you have pull-out drawers that pull out and lift so that you can make the most out of your space? So little things that aren't little things, and they also don't come with little price tags. And that's the important thing, is that if people really want to drill down to a lot of the things that they have to do, there's going to be a price tag associated with that. And so they've got to be prepared for that and know that that's money that they're interested in investing in their home if they're debating whether or not to downsize or sell.
Yeah. I'll tell you a quick story of modifications. So we had a family who had a fiberglass shower, and they had installed the suction cup grab bars in there. And over time, as you pull on those, it makes the suction cup come loose. And so that had come off the shower and was laying on the kitchen counter. And when we were there, we were like, why is this on the kitchen counter? This is not where this is supposed to be. And long story short, it had detached and needed to be put back on. It's like, oh, well, you really only use that when you're getting up and out of your shower chair. Well, no, we took the shower chair out, because this is an individual with Parkinson's, by the way. And we took the shower chair out because the little rubber pieces on the bottom of it were breaking. And so it was unstable. So we took it out of the shower. Okay. You know, 5 minutes on Amazon and $10 later, those are on their way. But they hadn't replaced the shower chair, and they hadn't replaced the rubber pieces, and they hadn't put the grab bar back on the shower yet. And so it was this sort of perfect storm of things, modifications that had been made to help keep everyone at home for as long as possible. And yet somewhere along the way, we were making choices to say, no, we're not really using that right now. And all that is to say, just once something gets done, you may have to continue to monitor and make sure that those things are still being utilized the way they need to be utilized for each individual family.
Exactly. Yes, we had a client that was using their chairlift up the stairs to take groceries up. So they would put the groceries in the chairlift. They would walk up the stairs, but the groceries would go up in the chairlift. So, and you know, maintenance costs of some of these things, like a chairlift. I mean, that's, you know, if you're putting something big inside your home or making a major change, you also do have the upkeep, whether it's a suction grab bar or something else. There will be replacement cost and upkeep associated with some of those things that you've got to be aware of going into it as well.
Yeah, we just had a family install an elevator in their home, which is great. That's going to be amazing. But also now you have to upkeep an elevator. And if you sell the house, the next family has to be willing to upkeep an elevator that's in the home. So, yeah, they come with the cost, and then they come with an ongoing maintenance as well.
Right. Yeah.
You have a program called The Art of Purpose. Can you tell us about that? And, you know, what is the purpose of The Art of Purpose?
Yeah. So The Art of Purpose program is our creative engagement program. And that program is designed to create very curated activities for an individual who might need to have something modified for them to be able to continue to enjoy a sport or a hobby that they once enjoyed, or also to be able to provide some creative engagement to someone that maybe hasn't over the course of their lifetime had an opportunity to be exposed to different things. Mm-hmm. And that might be an area where they're sort of suffering a little bit. They're not able to socialize with people because they don't have hobbies and different things that can be shared with other people. And so our creative engagement specialists are coming in, assessing the person's needs, but also their interest, mm-hmm. and really putting together a programming that speaks to them, but that's also compatible with where they are, mm-hmm. Whether that's a certain functional level, whether it's meeting them where they are with respect to cognitive decline that person might be experiencing. And we're really just trying to bring them kind of that, it's not the tangible part, but it's the joy and the sense of meaning and purpose and the things that only come with experiencing something firsthand. And we're trying to bring that to people in different environments, whether they're at home. If a person's aging in place and they have a caregiver that's there with them, they're getting the care that they need, but they're not getting the other components that they'd be getting at an assisted living, like the engagement and the activities. And so the idea is that we're trying to meet those needs, mm-hmm. of an individual in whatever environment they're in. And sometimes that might be, the original case that we had that kind of gave us, planted the seed for this program long ago was this gentleman that he and his wife had tickets to the symphony. She was his caregiver and she died quite suddenly. And he loved going to the symphony and they didn't have any other family. He didn't have anybody to take him. And so we began taking him and he didn't remember people's names that sat around them, but everyone knew who he was and knew who he and his wife were. And so to be able to build those relationships with the people that sat around, he and his wife for so many years, and to see them get excited to see him walk in. I mean, this would be something that if he knew we were going to the symphony on Saturday, he laid out his clothes on Monday. I mean, it was all he could talk about. And so still being able to provide moments like that for people, it seems like something very small, but to a person as they age, as their world gets a little bit smaller, mm-hmm. it can end up being a really huge thing. So it's an excellent program. We're super excited about it.
Well, and to give people purpose and meaning and socialization as, mm-hmm. As their physical situation changes, to still have those opportunities and connections is powerful. We need that as humans.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So one of the things a lot of families ask us to do is help them figure out if it is time to move, and if so, where they should go. What are the different options that are out there? And it's a maze. So how do you help families kind of navigate through what the different options are and what the prices are and how you pay for it? Kind of walk us through that process.
Yeah. So I definitely, housing is a big transition that families have to go through and an older adult. And I think the good news is that there are so many more options. When you're working with an older adult who is in their 80s or 90s, they're envisioning a very old system that no longer exists. And that's a very good thing. They're imagining when they were young, going to visit grandma in the nursing home. And I mean, that was kind of the stuff that nightmares are made of. It's very clinical setting. We don't really have to go back that far in America to when the people that were in nursing homes were older adults and anyone with mental health problems, because mm-hmm. They didn't have another place for them. And so, so there are actually older adults that have pretty traumatic memories of what care looked like then. Mm-hmm. And they don't have anything as a reference point for what it is now. Mm-hmm. And just in the last 30 years alone, there are so many different kind of micro points along the spectrum between independent living and the very end of life, you needing complete care. Mm-hmm. There are so many different opportunities for people to experience care in other environments that didn't exist just a few decades ago. And the innovation in this space continues to increase, which is good. So I think the importance of talking to an aging life care manager is that, one, we have clients in a lot of these communities, and so we're in and out and can tell you more than what you're going to get on the sales tour about, you know, the staff retention and what the actual experience of care is like, and right, how they handle emergencies and how communicative the staff is, and those sorts of things that should be a really important factor in decision making. But we're also, I think, one of the exciting things about our job is that we get to introduce people to things that they didn't know existed. Mm-hmm. Even within 55 plus communities, you know, you've have people that are downsizing into a 55 plus community, but it's a neighborhood on a golf course that has 3,000 homes, and you buy your home and it's, you basically have downsized into a ranch home, and that's the only thing that would make you think that it's a 55 plus community. Right. Otherwise, it looks like a normal neighborhood with a lot of stuff going on. But then other independent livings have layers of services that they provide. And so understanding the difference, the cost point, mm-hmm, being able to advise families on when you should be using more of your money. If you have, you know, everybody's coming into aging with a relatively limited pot of money. It's going to be in different forms. But if we're looking at, you know, the total assets that someone has, trying to help figure out when does it make sense based on how expensive different levels of care are, when does it make sense to be using the money, and when does it make sense to be pulling back a little and being a little bit pickier about some of the costs associated with care. But I think that's one of the more exciting things, is that there just is so much out there within the continuum of care. And there's really something for everybody. And I say, if there's not something for everybody, you haven't looked hard enough, because there really is something for everybody out there. So,
yeah. And I think most people don't know what they don't know about senior living. Again, they have maybe a perception from when they were young about it's all nursing homes, or you get a lot of people who drive past a senior living building and it looks pretty from the outside, so they just assume that, hey, it's close to my house and that'll be the place that I go. But it's actually the total wrong level of care, because they've never been in the building or really found out what they offer. And so getting through that kind of maze of what are those different levels, all the different nuances of what they can offer, because even assisted livings, you know, some assisted livings will take on really complex levels of care and offer a lot of services, and other assisted livings won't. And you don't know that without being in the buildings, going in them, and, you know it, working with them on a day-to-day basis. When you're coming into this as a family member, it's really overwhelming, and trying to figure out those differences is really tough.
Yeah, it is. And I think people have a vague notion of what assisted living is. But like you said, it's almost comparing apples to oranges. It's almost impossible to find, even if you tour six assisted livings, I could find reasons probably that you haven't actually compared things that are equal. And so it really, it makes it more complicated. And that's the downside for families, is that really, to understand what's out there, you do have to go and tour, and you have to put the time in, and you have to, you know, make sure that you're a smart consumer. So that's kind of on the downside. But on the positive side of that, there are a lot of options out there. There's a lot of flexibility with what care looks like. And I think the best thing is that no decision that you make is super permanent. And so you can also undecide, you know, change your mind about things if you get somewhere and it's not what you thought it would be, or if the company gets bought out. I mean, there's a lot of things that could happen to change things in our industry. So that's the other part about having a conversation about transitions with people, is that we also go into it that, you know, this is not like buying a house that you have, right, to be happy with for a 30-year mortgage. This is, let's decide to move into this assisted living. And if you're here for 6 months and you don't like it and you want to go try this other place that was your number two, we give them the notice and we hit the road. Yep. So I think that letting people know that they have that kind of agency and ability to be flexible, I think, is super important. I will say, the reason that this conversation is so critical is that a lot of people will say, I will make that decision or I'll think about it once I need care. And so I always say, well, once you need care, first of all, you're not eligible to go to a lot of the places that maybe you have in mind. And I'm thinking about the large campuses, the continuing care retirement communities that have lots of levels of care. You're not going to be allowed to go in if you already need help. And a lot of people don't realize that. And then the other thing is, if you're waiting until you need care, you have what's available to you, what's available. It's not driven by what you'd like. It's driven by you need care now, and these are the places that have openings now. And so, again, it just goes back to what we said at the beginning, having the conversations before you have to and doing the legwork before you need to, before an emergency, puts you in a much better place so that you're, when you get to a point where there's a crisis or where care needs increase, that you've got the ability to make a decision that you can feel good about, but that's also going to be probably closer to what you want as opposed to just whoever had an empty bed at the time.
At the time, yeah. And and just because you are still living at home does not mean you're actually independent and that you can still go into an independent living, because that you may need care and you just haven't gotten it while you're at home. I've run into that several times too. Well, yeah. Thank you so much for spending your time with us today. If you had one final thing that you would like for people to walk away from our conversation with, what would it be?
Oh, gosh. Well, first of all, thank you for having me. This has been great. We could talk for hours, I'm sure. It's hard to narrow it down to one thought, but I think if I had anything to say, it would be start talking. Start talking to your loved ones. Make conversations about aging normal. Okay. That's the best thing that we can do. It's the best thing we can do to honor the older adults in our world. But it actually will serve us very well as family members if we can just start talking about aging.
Yeah, it will serve the older people and everyone else in the family, because you'll all be on the same page.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Where can people find you if they would like to connect with you?
Yeah, sure. Jennifer Sakai on LinkedIn. Put the spelling of my name in the episode notes. And then our website is caregivingcorner.com.
And you're located in?
We're in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.